from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, from the world headquarters of Le Show, the actual Le Show Dome, this broadcast comes to you now. This is it. This is it coming to you now. News of the godly. The Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese spent more than $1 million over 4 months last year to deal with allegations of sexual abuse by priests. The Kansas City Star reports that a diocese insurance program incurred $631,000 in costs relating to clergy sexual abuse from July through October. That's money to counsel victims and defend the diocese, its employees and priests, in 24 lawsuits. Another $427,000 is tied to an independent investigation by a former U.S. attorney at the request of the diocese. Reverend Sean Radigan's defense isn't being bankrolled with money from diocesan funds. Radigan has pleaded not guilty to child pornography charges stemming from claims that he took hundreds of pornographic pictures of children. After the images were found on his computer, the diocese waited 5 months to turn copies of them over to police. That case has sparked multiple lawsuits. 23 priests have been accused of sexual misconduct with minors, 7 of whom were accused after they died. Of the remaining 16, the report says one has been dismissed from the priesthood, 4 are in the process of being dismissed, 6 retired and were later barred from the ministry, 2 are on administrative leave, and 3 have died. In case you're keeping score, ladies and gentlemen. News of the godly. And last week we had the story of Ben Stein, trying to get some more of Ben Stein's money, apparently, suing Kyocera for hiring somebody that looked like him, i.e. glasses, bow tie, sport jacket, in his lawsuit claiming that that's a look he owns. This week, even nervier, perhaps. Randy Michaels, former head of Clear Channel, now head of a new radio company, was a recipient of another infringement letter from CBS, intellectual property lawyers. CBS wants Michaels to know that they own the famous trademark, Traffic and Weather Together. So don't ever say that, or CBS will come after you. I've, for years, ladies and gentlemen, been on a crusade to separate traffic and weather, just to take care of situations like this. And one note on the election results last night. Now, in hindsight, you can see that it was pretty clever of Newt Gingrich to have asked South Carolina for an open primary. Hello, welcome to the show.
on TV.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And this week, let me preface this by saying that when you think of legendary rhythm and blues cities, you think of Detroit, New Orleans, of course, Memphis, perhaps, Philly. You might not think of L.A. And this week, coincidentally, two really major L.A.-based rhythm and blues, in one case also jazz performers, passed away. So today on the show, we're featuring music of Johnny Otis. I grew up in a house across the street, at least for a little while, from the house where Johnny Otis's band rehearsed. That didn't make too big an impression on me because it was, you know, my parents were just going, that noise across the street. But then later on, I had the pleasure of doing a radio program on another station in this city, not the one I'm currently on or not the one I'll be on next. And Johnny Otis followed me. He didn't follow me home. He followed me on the air. And amazing guy. Writer, performer, producer, promoter, played a bunch of instruments. And although you might not be able to guess it from that record or the people he worked with or the genre of music in which he made his career, he was a Greek immigrant. At one time in Los Angeles, he had a radio show, a TV show. He did live concerts. And the other person we lost this week was, of course, Etta James. Anyway, you'll be hearing their music, unless you're listening to the podcast, in which case, we love you. Now, news of the atom. Because
clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, safe, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, safe, too safe to meet.
Addie, how'd you spend your week in L.A.?
Working on my tan.
It's an Adam joke, ladies and gentlemen. Dateline Limerick, not Ireland. The federal government wants Ixalan to explain how it intends to raise more than $100 million needed to guarantee that one of the generators at the Limerick nuclear plant can be decommissioned when it is finally shut down. The answer to that question may be, you want any guesses? Yes, a hike in electric rates for customers. Why shouldn't you pay to shut it down? Last week, Peter Sanford, a nuclear regulatory commissioner, project manager for plant licensing, wrote to the chief nuclear officer of Exelon Nuclear and noted that as December 30th, 2010, Exelon had $528 million in a fund geared toward paying for the cost of decommissioning the reactor. Once the plant finally closes, however, the NRC staff, quote, has determined that the minimum amount of decommissioning funding assurance required by NRC rules is $628 million. All right, then. Pony up, ladies and gentlemen, because it's cheap. Pay more because it's cheap. Dateline Richland, Washington, workers at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation's waste treatment plant fear retribution if they bring up safety concerns. That's according to a new report from an independent investigative arm of the Federal Department of Energy. I think we had that on the broadcast. Yes, we did. So we're not going to have it again. That didn't happen. But this did. Metal tissue holders contaminated with low levels of radioactive material may have been distributed to Bed Bath & Beyond stores in more than 20 states, federal regulators said. Nuclear Regulatory Commission spokesman David McIntyre said the home products company had pulled the tissue holders from the stores. Sounds painful, pulling your tissue holder. But he said there is little to risk in human health But it's better to avoid unnecessary exposure to radiation. So, why don't you step in that X-ray machine? If someone has one of those, they could receive a small radiation dose from it, he said. For example, someone keeping one of the boxes on a vanity in the bathroom and spending about 30 minutes a day near it for a year would receive the equivalent of a couple of chest X-rays. What about people who like to spend more time in the bathroom? After the Fuk nuclear accident, Canadian health officials assured a nervous public that virtually no radioactive fallout had drifted to Canada. Last March, a Health Canada monitoring station in Calgary detected an average of 8.1 becquerels per liter of radioactive iodine. In rainwater, data now shows the level easily exceeded the Canadian guideline of 6 becquerels. That's an acknowledgement by Eric Pellerin, chief of Health Canada's Radiation Surveillance Division. It's above the recommended level for drinking water, he said. Anytime you sample it, it should not exceed the guideline. Canadian authorities, however, did not disclose the high radiation reading at the time. You see, it's Canada. In contrast, the state of Virginia issued a don't drink rainwater advisory in late March after iodine levels in rain in a nearby city spiked to 3.4 becquerels per liter on one day. That was less than half the level seen in Calgary during the entire month of March. Radioactive iodine also appeared in smaller amounts in March in Vancouver, Winnipeg, and Ottawa. These other levels didn't exceed the limit for drinking water, but the level in Ottawa did surpass the more stringent ceiling for drinking water used by the United States EPA. The data still aren't posted on Health Canada's webpage devoted to the impact of Fukushima. Pellerin said he doesn't know why Health Canada didn't make the data public. I can't answer that. The communication aspect could be improved. They're nice in Canada, aren't they? Following the nuclear disaster at Chernobyl 25 years ago, the Soviet government chose long-term... That's a repeater. Yes, indeed, Lee Doodley. Renewable energy sources. And so is that. Why don't I look before I pack? The operator of Torness nuclear power station in Scotland has been ordered to make safety improvements and urged to boost its defenses against jellyfish. A new report from Nuclear Watchdog, the Office for Nuclear Regulation, has highlighted issues with checks on safety valves, concerns about radioactive waste discharge pipes, and a lack of self-closing safety doors. The inspectors did highlight that safety overall was adequate. That's what I want in my nuclear plant, adequate safety. One of the more high-profile incidents that had occurred recently was the blockage of the coolant inlets at Torness by large numbers of jellyfish last June, which led to both reactors being shut down. While staff took the correct action, the ONR report said it had presented a challenge to station systems related to safety. The manager of the plant was asked to review the safety systems, and as a result, new arrangements for introducing a heightened state of alert for external hazards has been implemented, i.e. the jellyfish horn. It's a simulation. Waste in underground tanks at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation may have, this is new, much more plutonium than previously thought. That's according to a report by a Hanford contractor that's just been leaked to public radio in Washington. It's also according to the latest high-profile whistleblower to raise serious concerns about that waste treatment plant being built at Hanford. Donna Bush says she's where the nuclear safety buck stops. She's the manager for environmental and nuclear safety at Hanford's waste treatment plant. I believe the waste treatment plant is needed, she says. We need to get the waste out of the tanks. We have to. They're in degraded state. They're long past their life cycle. That is the tanks where the waste is sitting now. And those tanks near the Columbia River are in danger of leaking more radioactive sludge into the ground, or worse, one could rupture. Ouch.
Couldn't happen.
No editorializing. The waste treatment plant is a massive complex of buildings all meant to separate, mix, and ready that radioactive sludge before it's turned into glass logs for long-term storage. Wouldn't you like one of those for the Christmas fireplace? a Hanford glass log. That's how we monetize this. It's a glass log. It never burns. Oops. But here's the thing, Bush says. There are serious engineering problems with the process that haven't been figured out yet, and the longer those issues go unresolved, the more expensive it will be to fix them. We continue to build it even with these big, huge, lingering issues, she says. Like, is criticality safety a concern? Do we have fire protection programs that will actually make sure systems perform as they're intended? Is there a control strategy to make sure pipes don't blow up from a nuke, from a hydrogen explosion? Those are big issues, she says, and there are even good people working on that. But not a lot of people are willing to stand up and say, no, time out, we don't have enough information. She says Hanford engineers have recently revised their estimates for how much plutonium is in the nuclear site's sludge. Hanford engineers used to think they had 10 kilograms of plutonium in the tanks. They now believe they've got between 30 and 130 kilograms. That's a range. I could live with that. The nuclear bomb in Nagasaki had 6 kilograms of plutonium. The worst case scenario, Bush says, Hanford could have 13 times more plutonium than previously thought. Since day one of the project, many years before I got here, she says, the project has designed the plant assuming criticality was incredible, which means it would never happen. That's when radioactive atoms release a burst of energy. Addie's running around the room right now to demonstrate. So this new information that we've received, that was prepared by very smart people looking through old records, has given us new information, meaning criticality could be probable in the plant. We don't know what the design solutions are, but they could be significant, Bush says. You have to remember, Bush adds, once this thing gets built, there's no way to fix it. She says, we're building vessels in black cells, which means once we shut that door, we are never going back in there. Sounds like Saturday Night Live. The Palisades nuclear power plant, which sits on the shores of Lake Michigan, could soon be downgraded by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to a status making it among the nation's 5 worst performing nuclear plants. We'll count those down for you one of these days. After a year of accidents, unexpected shutdowns, and safety violations, this is the result. The regional head of the NRC said last week that if performance does not improve, the agency would not hesitate to shut down the plant. Palisades is one of the nation's 10 oldest nuclear plants. We'll count those down for you. And after hitting the 40-year lifespan, last year its license was extended until 2031. I didn't even send a card.
That's editorializing.
No, it's kidding. Quite frankly, we find your performance troubling, and it declined in 2011, said the regional administrator, in a rare public rebuke of the plant owned by Entergy. Entergy acknowledged mistakes. One accident in September led to a loss of electricity at the plant that tripped its reactor and caused equipment to malfunction. The accident could have killed somebody, the plant's manager said last week in a shaken voice. That was one of at least 5 unexpected shutdowns of the plant in the last year after valves malfunctioned, seals leaked, or pumps failed. The NRC spent 1,000 extra hours last year just inspecting that plant. If all these failings and accidents line up in just the right way, we could have a very bad day at Palisades, said a staff member at Beyond Nuclear, a nuclear avoidance group. And finally.
Finally.
Yes. Dateline Tokyo. A powerful and independent panel of specialists appointed by Japan's parliament is challenging the government's account of the accident at Fuk and will start its own investigation into the disaster, including an inquiry into how much the March earthquake may have damaged the plant's structure even before the tsunami. Imagine that. An independent parliamentary investigation of a major disaster. I don't understand why they let that happen. We don't do that here. Ask New Orleans. The bipartisan panel with powers of subpoena is part of Japan's efforts to investigate the nuclear calamity, which has displaced more than 100,000 people, rendered wide swaths of land unusable for decades, and spurred public criticism that the government has been more interested in protecting vested industry interests than in discovering how three reactors were allowed to melt down and release huge amounts of radiation. Several investigations, including inquiries by the plant operator TEPCO and the government, have blamed the scale of the tsunami. But critics in Japan and overseas have called for a fuller accounting of whether TEPCO sufficiently considered historically documented tsunami risks and whether it could have done more to minimize the damage once waves hit the plant. Questions also linger as to the extent of damage to the plant caused by the earthquake before the tsunami hit. Any evidence of earthquake damage at the plant would cast new doubt on the safety of other reactors in quake-prone Japan. Tsunamis, of course, far less frequent. Kyoshi Kurokawa, chairman of the new Fuk Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Commission, said his investigation would have no sacred cows.
Uh-oh.
News of the... It's clean, it's cheap, it's news of the atom, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Addie, for your contribution. And now...
Superbug! We can't sweep your butt beneath the rug. You're screwing up all kinds of drug.
News of superbugs. A new study found increases in about 20 different antibiotic-resistant genes in pigs that were fed low doses of antibiotics. Pigs given low doses of antibiotics had more E. coli in their guts. And bacteria, those bacteria showed an increased resistance to antibiotics, according to new research. The study confirms the routine practice of feeding antibiotics to food animals increases drug resistance in the bacteria living in those animals. Practice is common at large livestock operations worldwide, but experts say it is helping spawn new types of antibiotic-resistant disease organisms, fueling a possible global public health crisis. Animals raised for meat at large livestock operations around the world are commonly given antibiotics to prevent disease and to help them grow bigger with less feed. In the United States, more antibiotics are used for healthy animals than for sick people. Healthy animals, 3. Sick people, 1. It's a controversial practice. And in this new study, Department of Agriculture researcher Thad Stanton and colleagues looked at bacteria coming out of pigs fed some of those antibiotics. They saw increases in about 20 different antibiotic resistance genes, including genes for resistance to one type of antibiotic that was not even fed to the pigs. We also saw increases in E. coli populations, which were unexpected, he says. We need to fatten them, though, with less feed. Don't you think? Sure you do. So, ladies and gentlemen, now news of the F-bomb foreclosure, the new F-bomb. Why, many have wondered, few have chosen, why there have been, like, zero prosecutions of the malefactors involved in the great mess, the great financial mess that occurred starting in about 2000, well, that hit the fan starting about 2008. Reuters looked into it. Here's what they come up with. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer, you may remember him from the Clinton administration. He's head of the Justice Department's criminal division. That's where they keep the... No. Were partners for years at a Washington law firm that represented a who's who of big banks and other companies at the center of alleged foreclosure fraud. That's what Reuters found out. The firm, Covington & Burling, one of Washington's biggest law firms, law professors and other federal ethics experts said that federal conflict of interest rules required Holder and Breuer to recuse themselves, from any Justice Department decisions relating to law firm clients that they personally had done work for. Both the Justice Department and Covington declined to say if either official had personally worked on matters for the big mortgage industry clients. Reuters reported in December that under Holder and Breuer, the Justice Department hasn't brought any criminal cases against big banks or other companies involved in mortgage servicing, even though copious evidence has surfaced of apparent criminal violations in foreclosure cases. And judges around the country, state court judges, have been increasingly critical of the practices of mortgage servicers. These are the companies that collect the checks or run the foreclosures for whoever it is, if anyone, that's holding the mortgage. The evidence shows widespread forgery, perjury, obstruction of justice, and illegal foreclosures on the homes of thousands of active duty military personnel. Support the troops, won't you? That evidence includes records from federal and state courts and local clerks' offices around the country. While Holder and Brewer were partners at Cummington, the firm's clients included Bank of America. Hey, President Obama is going to give his acceptance speech for the nomination at Bank of America Stadium. That's good symbolism. Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo, as well as at least one other bank that is among the 10 largest mortgage servicers. Cummington also represented Freddie Mac, but not as a lobbyist, as an historian. In enforcement investigations by federal financial regulators. Particular concern is Cummington's involvement with MERS. You've heard about MERS on the Eve Smith interviews on this broadcast. MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, has been at the center of complaints about false or erroneous mortgage documents. Cummington, in the late 1990s, provided legal opinion letters needed to create MERS in the first place. MERS, registers sales or transfers of mortgages electronically on a private database, thereby evading or avoiding the usual requirement to register those changes in a local property office and pay a fee. By 2010, MERS claimed to own about half of all mortgages in the United States, roughly 60 million loans. Evidence in numerous state and federal court cases has shown that MERS authorized thousands of bank employees to sign their names as MERS officials. The banks allegedly drew up fake mortgage assignments, making it appear falsely that they had standing to file foreclosures, and then had their own employees sign the documents as MERS vice presidents. Cummington in 2004 also wrote a crucial opinion letter commissioned by MERS, providing legal justification for its electronic registry. It's not known what extent, if any, Cummington continues to represent these organizations since Holder and Brewer left. A Cummington spokeswoman said the firm had, say it with me now, no comment. Just in case you're wondering why no prosecutions. There's your answer, ladies and gentlemen. But wait, there's more on another subject. News of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. Senior executives of the News of the World, the tabloid newspaper formerly run by Nice Corp before they closed it down, quote, deliberately destroyed evidence as part of a conspiracy, unquote, to cover up the extent of phone hacking. That's the allegation, at least published this week in the British newspaper The Telegraph, not owned by Nice Corp. Computers used by journalists at the newspaper News of the World were destroyed in 2010, a few months before Scotland Yard began a fresh investigation into voicemail interception. Isn't that coincidental? Isn't that cute? As News Group Newspapers, part of News International, part of Nice Corp, agreed to pay more than $1.5 million in damages to 37 victims of phone hacking this week, the victims' lawyers made a series of claims about directors of the company. A joint statement by three leading law firms stated the compensation had been agreed, quote, on the basis that senior employees and directors of News knew about the wrongdoing and sought to conceal it by deliberately deceiving investigators and destroying evidence, unquote. The statement stopped short of naming any directors, but when the computers were broken up, News Group Newspapers was headed by James Dun-dun-dun Murdoch. I haven't seen Rupert tweet about this yet. I wonder why. A spokesman for the company said no admissions have been made of senior employees or directors being aware of evidence being destroyed. Eight computers used by journalists implicated in hacking had been destroyed when the company moved to a new office. Because why would you want to take the computers when you can just destroy them and buy new ones and deduct the cost from what? Here is a company that has deliberately destroyed the key computers, and it is now standing here saying, we've only got the ones from after that, so it's disproportionate to search them. That's a defense or a plaintiff's lawyer talking. Company sources said any emails sent from the destroyed computers were stored on a server, the contents of which have been given to police. News has promised, as part of the agreement reached with the victims of hacking, to carry on searching its archives for more evidence of illegal activity, which it will hand over to the victims' lawyers. The statement said, quote, this was important because attempts are being made to reconstruct email archives which had been destroyed by News Group in an apparent attempt to cover up wrongdoing. Key, ladies and gentlemen, in the settlements announced this week with these multiple 37, is it? Phone hacking victims. No hush clause. That's unique for NICE Corp. No non-disclosure, no shut up and take the money clause. A high court judge said the company had made an admission of sorts that it engaged in a deliberate cover-up. Justice Voss, the judge presiding over the hacking cases, said he had seen evidence which raised compelling questions about whether you concealed, told lies, actively tried to get off scot-free. Now, here's a fine bit of lawyering on the part of NICE Corp. Even though they did not admit the allegations that management knew and had lied and all of that, they said the damages paid to the victims could be assessed, quote, on the basis of the facts alleged. That is to say, the facts that they won't admit to. That's nutty. While the company refused to admit its former directors and senior executives had presided over a cover-up, it agreed that aggravated damages could be calculated as if the allegations that they lied, obstructed justice, and destroyed evidence were true. So NICE Corp, it's so nice, it's subjunctive. That is nice. A lawyer for one of the victims said it was surprising that News Corp had agreed to the admissions on this basis. You'd expect an organization with the resources of the Murdoch Empire to fight these sorts of allegations. For the purpose of reaching these settlements only, said News Corp's statement, News agreed that the damages to be paid to claimants should be assessed as if these were the case. In court, as each of the 18 settlements were read out, Michael Silverleaf, the lawyer for NICE Corp, said he was there to offer, quote, sincere apologies to the claimant for the damages as well as the distress caused by the unlawful access of messages. That's nice. Nice people doing nice things. News of News Corp, copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Give you the world. Now you find that you've been misused. Talk to me.
This is the show where you can play that Barry sax all day. And now, news from outside the bubble. First, a really nutty story from The Hindu. The Hindu is a newspaper in guess where. You may have heard the story about Salman Rushdie canceling an appearance in India because of a death threat. Here's the other side of that story. Local intelligence officials in Rajasthan invented information that hitmen were preparing to assassinate Salman Rushdie in a successful plot to deter him from attending the Jaipur Literature Festival. That's according to highly placed police sources. Sources in the federal administration told The Hindu that Rajasthan police intelligence officials had claimed that the threat to Rushdie came from two underworld hitmen whom they identified as Altaf Batli and Aslam Kongo. The intelligence officials said that an Islamist terrorist, Saqib Hamid Nachan, was suspected of financing the plot. I received a call from one of Mr. Rushdie's friends on Friday asking about these names, said a senior official of the Mumbai police who deals with organized crime. I thanked him for giving me something to laugh about, unquote. The officer said the Mumbai police's dossiers on organized crime figures had no reference to individuals who might be using those names. The third name is of a former student Islamic Movement of India leader who remains under 24-hour covert surveillance, though he's been acquitted of past charges of participating in terrorist attacks. Maharashtra's Director General of Police, P.K. Subramaniam, went on record to deny his force had provided information on a potential threat to Rushdie. Intelligence sources in New Delhi said no threat to Rushdie's life had been reported to the multi-agency center, the intelligence bureau's hub at which all terrorism-related threats are discussed at high-level afternoon meetings. I'd love to go to those meetings. Now, a new story from The Guardian of London. This seems inevitable. This just seems like, yeah. Two undercover police officers secretly fathered children with political campaigners they had been sent to spy on and later disappeared completely from the lives of their offspring. In both cases, the children have grown up not knowing that their biological fathers, whom they've not seen in decades, were police officers who had adopted fake identities to infiltrate activist groups. Both men have concealed their true identities from the children's mothers for many years. One of the spies was Bob Lambert. You know Bob, who already admitted that he tricked a second woman into having a long-term relationship with him as a part of an intricate attempt to bolster his credibility as a committed political campaigner. The second police spy followed the progress of his child and the child's mother by reading confidential police reports which tracked the mother's political activities and life. Family values, ladies and gentlemen, no matter where you look. Also from The Guardian, mutual mistrust and contempt between local and foreign forces in Afghanistan that often borders on hatred is one of the main reasons why Afghan troops increasingly turn their guns on their NATO commanders. This according to a damning new report. The research commissioned by the U.S. military said American soldiers enrage their Afghan colleagues with what the report describes as extreme arrogance. Who, us? We are exceptional. Bullying and crude behavior. They must be watching commercials, not dealing with the real troops. It also heavily criticized as profoundly intellectually dishonest NATO claims that the killing of alliance troops by Afghan soldiers is extremely rare. The data suggests incidents such as the killing on Friday of four French soldiers, quote, reflect a rapidly growing systemic homicide threat, a magnitude of which may be unprecedented between, quote, allies, unquote, in modern military history, end quote. The report, prepared for the U.S. military, warned that the problem is now so serious it is provoking a crisis of confidence and trust among Westerners training and working with Afghan national security forces. According to the report prepared by behavioral scientist Jeffrey Borden, the number of attacks has been growing. While some of these incidents involved Taliban infiltrators, Borden believes many resulted from, quote, deep-seated animosity often stimulated by social and personal conflicts. Based on interviews with 613 Afghan security force members, the document paints an extremely bleak picture of mutual contempt Well, at least it's mutual. And misunderstanding between the two sides. U.S. troops regard their Afghan allies as untrustworthy, dishonest, incompetent, and practicing, quote, repulsive hygiene, unquote. Get them some Lysol. Just do a chop or drop of Lysol. What are you waiting for? For their part, the Afghans have been provoked into fights and even attempts to kill by behavior that many Americans, well, here's the behavior, you judge. Urinating in public, cursing at, insulting, and being rude and vulgar to Afghan force members, and unnecessarily shooting animals. Yeah! USA! The factors that create the most animosity included U.S. military convoys blocking traffic, returning fire, and insurgents in an apparently indiscriminate way, risking civilian lives, naively using flawed intelligence sources, hello, curveball, and conducting raids on Afghans' private homes. Lessons learned, everybody. Lessons learned. And finally, from The Independent in London, a midwifery leader has expressed concern about the commercialization of pregnancy and the growing trend for expectant mothers to hold fetus parties. Just wanted to say the phrase fetus parties for your listening pleasure. News from outside the bubble. Ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. It was a bad year on Wall Street in some ways. Wall Street stocks and profits took a beating last year, but in one corner of the street took a lighter hit, the compensation paid to chief executives. Three big banks disclosed on Friday what their top executives will receive in deferred stock for their work in 2011. Brian Foley, a compensation expert in White Plains, said that for top executives, he would have expected the belt to come in a few more notches this year, given the bank's lackluster performance. He said executive pay, suite pay packages might further lower morale inside the banks. A lot of people in the middle took big hits this year. It could create some big us versus them issues, he said. The chief exec of Citigroup, Vikram Pandit, he got deferred stock in the bank valued at $3.7 million. On top of his annual base salary of $1.7 million. So his disclosed pay for 2011 is $5.45 million. Citibank will disclose the rest of his pay, whether it be upfront or deferred in March. In addition, Pandit last year was awarded a $16.7 million retention bonus because he stuck around, plus stock options that could add another $6.5 million to the package's overall value. Citigroup's rival, J.P. Morgan Chase, had a rough year on the stock market, falling 22%. Still, Chief Executive Jamie Dimon was awarded $17 million in stock for his work in 2011. His total pay for the year last year came to $23 million. His total pay is expected to be roughly the same this year. So at least in the top floors of the largest firms, the legends of the middle-aged bonus babies are secure.
Bonus. he's sitting, tomorrow he's quitting. He's my bonus baby, keeping his karma, the country goes crazy. Bonus baby, pulling the chain and protecting his daisy. He keeps me in diamonds, three cans of mink. Cristal is the only thing he'll let me drink. I'm in the green, he's in the pink. To the moon he's flown us, thanks to his bonus. They bailed out his firm to keep it on track, and someone upstairs was a blade smoking crack. Now they want baby to give his box back, but it's balls that he's shown us, he's keeping his bonus. He's my bonus baby.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside. Sorry, the apologies of the week. What was I thinking about? I know what I was thinking.
We're so sorry.
Thinking about something else. Thinking about the last segment. When Martin Luther King Jr. said he had a dream, this likely wasn't what he meant. A flyer promoting a Miami strip club's I Have a Dream bash featuring King holding wads of cash next to scantily clad women, as its creator taking plenty of flack. Miami Beach graphic designer Jeffrey Darnell Paul says he didn't realize a flyer made for The Office strip club would generate the controversy it has. I wasn't trying to disrespect anybody. It wasn't on my mind that it would escalate to something like this. It was just supposed to be a promotional thing. It wasn't about disgracing Martin Luther King. It wasn't about that. It was proposed to me that, like a birthday bash for Martin Luther King, I put a flyer together without thinking about the effects it would have, said Paul, who's also known as DJ Big Boy. It's something I didn't really think about. I got plenty of phone calls, people calling from Chicago, Ohio, California. If I could have, I would have taken it back ahead of time. What was I thinking? Promotion, he said. I apologize about it. I'm taking full responsibility. I wish it could have gone down a different way, but I'm learning from it, and trust me, I'm not going down that route again. That's right. No more promotion. British Airways apologized this week for an error that left passengers on board a flight from Miami to London. In a state of panic and shock, passengers traveling on flight 206 were about 3 hours into their flight when an announcement warned them to brace themselves for an emergency water landing because the plane was about to go down. This is an emergency. We will shortly be making an emergency landing on water. The taped message said, played at about 3 a.m. The cabin erupted in panic as startled passengers woke to the announcement and feared for their lives. The crew played a second announcement a minute later, however, telling passengers to ignore the warning. In reality, the plane was cruising safely at 35,000 feet. The flight continued safely to London, where the disembarking passengers were met by British Airways representatives, handing out letters apologizing for the error. Pre-recorded announcement, like they wouldn't do that live. Okay. That's for consistency's sake, I guess. Eddie Brill has lost its job booking comedians for Late Show with David Letterman after making comments to a New York Times profile writer that some considered sexist. Brill subsequently apologized, saying, "It is time for me to accept the consequences of my printed words and to learn from this." Well, go learn with DJ Big Boy. There's apparently a learning curve going on. Pier Luigi Foschi, the CEO of Costa Cruises, owner of the Costa Concordia, apologized for the disaster, then told reporters at a press conference in Genoa, "We need to acknowledge the facts and we cannot deny human error." He explained all his ships have their routes programmed into navigational systems before they embark. The Concordia left its pre-programmed route in a maneuver that was, quote, unapproved, unauthorized, and unknown to management. Deadline Koge, Denmark. A Danish political party leader said the appearance of a swastika in an advertisement was unintentional, and she apologized. And Nielsen, chairwoman of a local association of the Dansk Folkeparti, said the swastika in the party's logo in a weekend advertisement in a newspaper was the result of her mistakenly downloading an altered version of the logo when creating the ad. "It is a deeply regrettable mistake for which I apologize," she said. "Mistakes happen. If I could do it again differently, I would. I should have been more vigilant. I'm really sorry." This highlighted, the ad in question highlighted a meeting involving Morten Messerschmidt, the party's member of the European Parliament. He drew criticism in 2007 when he allegedly gave a Nazi salute while in a bar in Tivoli. Dateline Fargo. Veteran University of North Dakota women's basketball coach Jean Roebuck, apologized Tuesday to North Dakota State University President Dean Bresciani for remarks he made Friday at a UNO booster luncheon. Roebuck referred to NDSU fans as, quote, racist blowhards, apparently in response to NDSU supporters and at least one football player chanting, "Sue suck," in a welcome home celebration after the Division I championship title. The booster meeting was held at Grand Forks. The remark was confirmed by several witnesses. In his email, Roebuck wrote, "I would like to apologize for an inappropriate comment I made in reference to North Dakota State. At a booster luncheon, as a lifelong resident of North Dakota, I have great respect for North Dakota State and the state of North Dakota. Please accept my apology." A Jersey City Assemblyman is apologizing for a misogynist, homophobic message that he says a friend posted to his Facebook wall during the Giants game last week. Assemblyman Charles Maynor, a Jersey City police detective who represents the 31st District, posted a message that said, "We are not going to just lay down, we come to play. Who the hell do you think we are? The Dallas Cowgirls or those gay birds from Philly? No, we are the New York Giants." Unquote. After having told the Jersey Journal had received at least one phone call complaining, Maynor apologized and said he only wrote half of the message. "I have to take full responsibility because it was under my name," he said. "I have no excuses other than me not looking before my friend did send the post." Don't let friends post under your name. Friends don't let friends post under their friends' names when they're friending. Dateline Buenos Aires, an Argentine newspaper apologized for a cartoon that the head of the country's Jewish community said was anti-Semitic. Página 12 published a statement saying it regrets the pain and distress caused by a cartoon that appeared the day before, which depicts a DJ performing at a concentration camp and Hitler instructing inmates to have fun because life is short. Vancouver police are caught in an embarrassing situation in which they're accused of beating up a man who they thought was a bank robber. He not only was not the right guy, it turned out no bank had been robbed. Vancouver police have apologized. "We're sorry. We've apologized yesterday. We apologize today," said a spokeswoman. But Dateline Boston, the director and the conductor of the nation's oldest independent music school, is apologizing for having a convicted sex offender, letting him film classes and concerts without seeking permission from supervisors. The founder of the Boston Philharmonic said he did so without inquiring into the exact nature of the charges, adding that this was a grave oversight. Xander apologized for upsetting the school community. And beyond. Kid Rock has apologized for smoking a cigar at a no-smoking event that he attended. But he said, "Sure, I get special treatment." You understand, he's Kid Rock. The president of El Salvador has apologized for the El Mozote massacre in December of 1981, the biggest massacre of civilians in the contemporary history of Latin America. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. That's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe. The USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it. HarryShearer.com and KCRW.com, available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And be just like making some more Holocaust jokes. If you could agree to join with me then, will you already? Thank you very much. Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter. Join the 54,000 followers at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as, say it with me now, the home of the homeless.